18. It came down without warning, nearly 400 days after the sky had finally closed over Janus. Seismic monitors, installed in concentric rings around Crabtree to detect signs of ice cap breakup, registered a single massive spike. Time of arrival analysis revealed that the seismic disturbance had originated in a very small area of the ice cap, about 100 kilometers south of Crabtree. Once the initial reverberations had died down, the ice cap flexing like a drum, the seismic activity returned to its usual quiet level. There were no aftershocks or hints of further movement after that first hammer blow. Though she was unwilling to dismiss the incident, Svetlana was equally reluctant to send out a lander to scout the area. Fuel and spare parts stocks were dwindling, and although Wang had lately become very good at coaxing miracles from the forge vats, complex spacecraft components were still a challenge. So Svetlana sent out a trio of tractors, which followed the line of superconductor for 20 kilometers before turning south over hard, ungraded terrain. The tractors fanned out until they could just see each other's strobe lights, then made a series of awkward sweeps through the area of the seismic disturbance, but they found nothing and the going was hard. When one of the machines damaged a mesh wheel, she ordered the trio to return home while they were still able to assist each other. She ordered a free flyer sent aloft, but the Free Flyer's cam was designed for inspecting hull damage at close quarters, not scanning a wide swath of ice at high resolution. Nor did it have the power to generate effective ground illumination. It merely zigzagged ineffectively back and forth until it ran out of fuel. A day passed while she brooded over the mystery. Should she risk committing a lander now, or send out another tractor sweep? All operations beyond Crabtree carried a measure of risk. Janus was quixotic, and the hammer blow might only indicate that something had happened deep in the machinery, even though the evidence, such as it was, suggested an event near the surface. There had been bangs and crashes in the night before, and people had soon learned not to let such things worry them, not when there were 100 other things more deserving of their anxiety. Then, as so often happened, some other affair pushed itself to the forefront of her attention. In fact, it was a constellation of distractions. Trouble from Nick Thale and the other Lind loyalists, pushing for concessions, symbolist agitation in the moor. Yet another round of troubling rumours concerning the death of Meredith Bagley. Had it really been accidental, or had someone made the centrifuge motor turn while she was deep inside its gears? A coldness between her and Parry that resurfaced occasionally, when she would catch Parry looking at her as if she was someone he barely knew, let alone liked. It would pass, it always did, but during these intermissions in their relationship she would glide into a neurotic spiral of self-examination. Parry was good. Parry was honest. If he had a problem with her, then there had to be a reason for it. Maybe she had taken too tough a stance on some things, but it was never Parry who had to make the difficult decisions. He thought he knew what she was going through, what it was costing her, but really he had no idea. He facilitated her decisions, but Svetlana made them. She never caught Parry awake at 3 a.m, his mind overheating like a 60-year-old reactor with jammed control rods. So she put the hammer blow to the back of her mind. 8 days later, she had cause to remember it again. There were reports of alien activity. This in itself wasn't anything unusual, and would not ordinarily have raised any flags. People had been seeing things on Janus for 13 years. Out on the ice, on a lonely drive between outposts, it was easy to understand why. The believers saw luminous entities, alien forms that could equally well have been angels or ghosts, who arrived with reassuring messages from loved ones left behind. The more spaced-out aquatics tended to see whales or dolphins in alien form. The Cosmic Avenger fans saw humanoid aliens that conformed to the show's stiflingly repetitive template for extraterrestrial intelligence. Now and then there was something weirder, but nothing that Svetlana considered evidence of a genuine external phenomenon. Granted, Janus could still surprise them, but nothing she had seen in 13 years had convinced her that the former moon was anything other than an automated mechanism. Indeed, the new reports were not of aliens per se, but of alien things. It was that difference that convinced her to look at them more seriously. All over Janus, from the moor to Eddytown to the outskirts of Crabtree itself, Normally reliable people were seeing things. Reports of sightings of swift, fleeting entities. Machines, it appeared, with a fluid, glassy appearance. They came in fast, sniffed around something, a generator, battery or superconductor junction, and then left, vanishing into the night as quickly as they had come. So far, no active cam had captured more than a few smudges. Were it not for the number of witnesses and the apparent reliability of their testimonies, Svetlana would have ignored the images. There was, of course, also the matter of the hammer blow. On more than one occasion, the visiting entities had appeared to originate from the same area. Something was happening. She sent out another party of tractors, six this time, but again they found nothing. Finally, she sent out Star Crusader, hoping that the lander, with its engine glow, floods, and elevated trajectory, might see something that the tractors and the earlier Free Flyer had missed. It did. The ice crater was wide but shallow, easy to miss amidst the ridged and wrinkled landscape. A trail showed where a tractor had passed within meters of its edge. At the base of the crater was a black disc, like a fat coin lying flat on one side. Its edge flung back reflected light, as if it had been polished to a high sheen. Crusader landed. Parry and Naohiro Uguru went out in Orlan 19 hard suits. They picked their way over the crater wall, then down to the coin-shaped object. The closer they got to it, the more massive and foreboding it became. It had looked quite small from the lander, but distance and scale were always difficult to judge on Janus. Up close, it seemed impossibly huge. It was 10 meters thick, perhaps 60 meters across. As they approached, warped versions of Parry and Naohiro loomed in the reflective edge, wide as monsters. "This must be what made all that noise," Parry said. Uguru touched the mirrored edge with a gloved knuckle, the way firefighters were taught to test wires that might be carrying electricity. "It's cold," he said, as the glove's thermal readout updated on his HUD, "cold and slippery as ice. What do you think cut this edge so cleanly?"
"Good question, buddy."
But Parry was already looking up, craning back as far as he could go. He crunched elementary trigonometry. If the disc was 60 meters wide and the iron sky 20 kilometers above his head, then he was looking for a hole about a third of the apparent diameter of the full moon seen from Earth, if he could remember what a full moon looked like. But the iron sky was black, and there might well be total darkness on the other side of the hole. If the hot blue radiation of the spiker binary was shining through the hole, they would have detected it already. It would have lit up Janus like a welding torch in a dark room. But unless the sky had healed itself, the hole had to be up there. It was just a question of finding it. They would worry about who had cut it later.
"This is good, isn't it?" Uguru said. "It means someone's opened the tin. It means someone knows we're here."
Parry looked at him, recalling a similar conversation with Mike Takahashi 13 years and 260 light-years ago. "Could go either way," he said. It was many years since events had moved so quickly on Janus. There was inertia at first, as if a once great machine was now so encrusted with oil and filth that it could barely turn a cog. But once the movement began, it had no choice but to continue. Resources were reallocated and committed. Teams were broken up and reassembled in new formations. Crabtree hummed with expectation and rumor. Everywhere Svetlana went, everywhere her spies went, she heard the same thing. Something is happening. Men, women, and children alike were saying it, placing the emphasis on the second word, as if the events themselves needed encouragement, reassurance to keep happening. The iron sky began to feel like a lifting depression. No one wanted the hole in the sky to close up again. It was like the first light of dawn after an appallingly long night. Svetlana sent tractors out to drag the piece of sky back to Crabtree. She wanted to analyze it, cut it up, recycle it. There was more metal there, if indeed it was metal, than had ever been pilfered from the lava lines. Recovering it, however, turned out to be a more difficult task than she had anticipated. The harness kept slipping off the near frictionless edges. The tractors couldn't get enough grip to dislodge the disc from the depression it had stamped in the ice when it fell. None of their tools were sharp or strong enough to cut it into more manageable chunks. Svetlana permitted one abortive attempt to haul the disc out of the crater using the lander, then conceded defeat. It would have to stay where it was, for now. By then, they had established a small hamlet of domes and equipment shacks around the crater. Someone started calling it Underhole, and the name stuck. A superconducting line was reeled out from Crabtree and a smoothly graded tractor route carved into the ice. 20 kilometers above Underhole, there was also activity. The hole in the sky had been located. Scans had revealed a spot where the near-total absorption efficiency of the sky became perfect as radiation escaped to the outside world. But it was not completely dark outside. In the optical and near-infrared, the hole glowed slightly more brightly than the surrounding regions. With dark-adapted eyes and knowing exactly where to look, it could be seen from Underhole as a tiny circle of not quite absolute darkness. Its dimensions had been measured and found to match the piece that had dropped to the ground. The sky did not appear to be healing itself. Reports of alien sightings gradually died down. Nothing had been seen coming or going through the hole since its discovery. Perhaps the alien machines had already seen all that they needed to. After much consideration, Svetlana decided that it was safe to take a look at what was on the other side. Belinda Pegas stripped a spare free flyer to the chassis, then welded on as much high-res survey gear as the power and telemetry bus could run. She utilized the equipment Rockhopper would have once trained on comets for the benefit of Nick Thale and the other analysts: deep penetration radar, terrain mapping LIDAR, supercooled photon counting cams with intrinsic energy resolution, tools to unravel every secret light or matter could hold. She bolted on massive floodlights, and then even more massive fuel tanks and reaction thrusters to handle the swollen payload. "Okay," she said, when her new creation was ready, parked like a bright yellow wasp on a cradle 30 meters from Underhole. "Let's kick the tires and light the fires." Pegas programmed a vector into the free flyer, fired up the thrusters to haul it off the ground, and then watched as it made its way up to the hole. 20 clicks over Underhole, she took the joystick and slowed the free flyer to a hover. It nosed around the rim of the hole, recording the bright counterpart to the mirrored edge on the piece of sky lying below. Measurement of the diameter established that the hole had been cut through with something astonishingly fine, for there was no measurable difference in size between the hole and the piece that had dropped out of it. Perhaps the cutting tool had simply persuaded the interatomic bonds to unzip along a precise line. Pegas tipped the free flyer on end, so that its forward cam pointed out through the hole. Svetlana and Parry crowded around the meager little array of flexies that was the best they could assemble. Scratches and hexel dropouts blotted the image as the ailing gelware struggled to process the incoming telemetry. There wasn't much to see, just a blank absence, stained orange by the false color display, like the sodium-light sky over a big city. Graphics boxes framed the image portion, updating with line plots and columns of numbers. Once, they would have meant something to Svetlana, but now all she felt was a faint prickle of recollection. Fluency with mathematics, in the context of any kind of engineering discipline or physical science, was a use-it-or-lose-it skill. In 13 years, she had lost it badly. Now all she could do was brazen her way through and hope the likes of Pegas wouldn't spot the mile-wide dropouts in her understanding. "Radar?" Svetlana asked. "Seeing anything?" "Not sure," Pegas said, chewing on the tip of some strands of hair she had tugged into her mouth. "Something's bouncing back at me, but I'm not sure if I believe what I'm seeing." "Could be backscatter off the edge of the hole," Parry commented. "Used to get a lot of..." "Ain't backscatter," Pegas said. "Too far out for that. Too damn faint as well. Could be a logic ghost, something bouncing around in the overflow buffer. Don't think so, though." "How far out?" Svetlana asked. 80,000 kilometers, just over a quarter of a light second. Once Svetlana would have laughed at such a small distance. It was nothing compared to the operational sphere of Rockhopper, carved up into entire light hours. But for 13 years her world had been 200 kilometers across, and her mind had become accustomed to handling things on that scale. Now it struggled to make the mental adjustment back to the larger universe beyond the iron sky.
"We need to see what it is," Svetlana said. "Take us through. Maybe we'll have a better view on the other side."
Pegas looked over her shoulder.
You sure about this? Take us through. Pegasus nudged the joystick and powered the free flyer up through the hole. The silver edge reflected back the free flyer's lights, and then suddenly it was out, rising from the hole. Hold at 100 meters, Svetlana said. Pegasus nodded and brought the machine to a halt again, suspended on a breath of thrust. Pan around. Let's take a look at the hole from the outside. Other than the glimpse they'd obtained from the upper surface of the fallen disk, this was their first view of the other side of the iron sky. At first glance, there was nothing very surprising about it. The outer side was as smooth and dark as the inside surface, at least as far out as Free Flyer's floodlights were capable of reaching. It raced away in all directions, black and flat as an oil slick, but with its own dull luster. It's a tiny bit more reflective than the inner surface, Pegasus announced, but that's about the only difference. I think I can already see the curvature in the backscatter. We can map it if you like. There's enough fuel in the free flyer for a couple of loops. We'll lose contact with it once it drops over the horizon, won't we? Parry said. Most likely, but the autopilot should bring it back, provided the inertial compass keeps working. I want to find out where the hell we are first, Svetlana said. Are you still seeing that 80,000-click echo? Still there, Pegasus confirmed, although that's only part of it. Now that we're clear of the hole, I'm seeing a spread of return times. There are reflective surfaces a lot further out than 80,000 clicks, although the bounces are weaker. How far are we talking? Hundreds of thousands of kilometers, entire light seconds. Pan the cam around. See if you can pick up anything else now you have a wider field of view. I'm on it, Pegasus said with a hint of irritation, as if she didn't need to be told these things. Svetlana buttoned her lip. She was obviously trying too hard. Hey, Parry said, that looks like something. Yup, looks like, Pegasus agreed. Something was creeping into view as the free flyer changed its angle of study. The featureless orange background was still there, but now there was a kind of wavy line showing up along one side, like a glowing human hair trapped in the optics. Can you zoom in on that? Svetlana asked. Sorry, no. Didn't have time to install a Zoom platform. Svetlana nodded. She understood the pressure Pegasus had been under to put the free flyer together. It was a miracle that they had any pictures at all. Can you pull back? Broaden the field of view? Also a no-no, but we can raster scan the whole area, build up a picture in stripes and then stitch them together in flexi memory. It'll take a little while, though, and we'll be burning fuel like a bitch. Do it. Even if we don't have enough left to make an orbit, we can always do that later. Right now, I'd really like to know where we are. Lately, on Janus, things had a habit of taking longer than anyone expected, even when this trend was taken into account. The simple business of making the raster scan and gluing the elements together to produce a single mosaic ought to have been child's play. But the remaining flexies did not have enough combined memory to handle the image manipulation without some tricky algorithmic sleight of hand, which taxed Pegasus's ingenuity to its limits. Svetlana knew better than to pressure her, and to avoid the temptation to breathe down her neck, she took a tractor back to Crabtree on the new road, enjoying the mindless pleasure of just driving, hypnotized by the endless flow of the superconducting line. Emily was just out of school that afternoon, so she took her daughter out to visit Wang Zhanmin, who, Emily remembered from the last visit, had promised her a rocking horse. Svetlana half expected him to have forgotten, but he had it ready when they arrived, gleaming with vivid scarlet paint. Learning to make wood, or at least a close analogue of it, had been one of Wang's recent breakthroughs, and he was intensely pleased with himself. In recent months, the forge vats had been churning out the parts for wooden furniture, ornaments and toys, faster than Crabtree could use them. The lab was bursting with these new creations.
I made you this, Emily said, offering Wang a cardboard tube.
Wang popped the end on the tube and slid out a roll of paper. Svetlana looked over his shoulder. It was a painting of fish, swimming through rocks and fronds. The picture had been rendered with a childlike delight in the application of bright, clashing colors, but also a certain adult fastidiousness in the way the colors were never allowed to merge or blot. The sea was a joyous, saturated turquoise, and the striped and mottled fish seemed to float an inch or two closer to the viewer, as if they had been etched on a sheet of glass resting on the background.
Thank you,
Wang said, holding the picture to the light so that the paper shone like stained glass.
Anything to brighten this place up?
He looked at Svetlana and said under his breath,
Thank God for the kids. You hear that a lot these days,
she replied quietly.
I thought it would make you happy,
Emily said.
It does.
He looked down at the picture again, stretching it between his hands like a scroll.
It's lovely. Lovely and a little sad, but in a good way. Do you like your rocking horse?
Yes, thank you.
I'll make you another one when you're bigger, but this fellow should do you for now.
It's very kind of you, Uncle Wang, Svetlana said.
I'm glad I can make something, he said, shrugging.
She smiled quickly and looked away, not wanting to acknowledge the unspoken truth that hung between them. Stools and rocking horses were all very well, but no amount of colourful Wangwood knick-knacks was ever going to make up for the failing flexies. Svetlana ate a meal with Emily, and then they spoke to Parry on the link to Underhole. Parry asked Emily what she had been doing in school today, and promised he would see her soon. He put on a brave face, but Svetlana could see something there that he did not want his daughter to pick up on. When Emily was asleep, Svetlana dosed herself up with black market coffee, signed out an Orlan and drove back to Underhole, gunning the tractor at 50 kilometers per hour. Everyone was still awake when she cycled through the lock. They had been waiting for her.
I think we know where we are, Parry said, an edge of unease clouding his voice.
Pegas had finished stitching together the raster data. She had also begun to get a handle on the data from the deep penetration radar.
So tell me, Svetlana said, as she struggled out of the bulky suit.
We're inside a tube-shaped structure, Pegas said, directing Svetlana's attention to the mosaic image spread across the flexi array. The walls are dark, but there are filaments in them, wavy glowing tracks a bit like the lava lines. They're peaking at about 5,500 angstroms, which is why everything looks yellow-orange out there. We haven't seen any transits moving on them, but it does look like a similar technology.
If the Spikens have brought us here, then maybe we shouldn't be too surprised by that, Svetlana said.
That's what we figured.
The raster image looked like the view down a drainpipe, with perspective traced by the converging density of the wavy, intertangled lava lines. The first echo I got was off the near side wall, Pegas said. The tube's about 160,000 clicks across, so we're floating pretty near the middle. We're getting optical data about 200,000 clicks down the shaft. We'd see further if we had a better cam.
And the radar?
The radar bounces are coming back from much further down. We're reaching 2.5 light seconds into the tube before the echo peters out. It isn't a smooth spectrum of return times. There must be irregularities in the cladding acting as discrete reflecting surfaces.
And beyond the last echo?
Anyone's guess. One thing we can be pretty sure of, though. The tube reaches further than we can see.
And in the other direction?
Our view's not as good since Janus is in the way, but there's nothing to suggest we wouldn't see a similar picture.
Svetlana looked at Parry. You said you knew where we are. Are you going to let me in on the secret?
It's not a secret. We're exactly where we expected to be after 206 light-years. We've achieved slowdown. We're at Spiker.
And the Spiken structure?
He smiled gently.
We're in it, babe.
I don't...
Remember the scale of that thing? We always did have a hard time getting our heads around it. It looked skeletal, but remember what Bella said?
She bridled at the name.
What?
Just one of those longitudinal spars would have the internal surface area of 50,000 Earths. 1,000,000 Earths worth in the entire structure. Well, I think we're in one of those spars now, or maybe one of the cross connectors. The numbers fit. If it's a longitudinal spar, the tube could be 3 light minutes long. If we're seeing 2.5 light seconds into it, there's still a hell of a lot more tube down here.
We have to know for sure, she said.
We've been inside one cage for 400 days. I don't like the idea of punching through and finding another set of walls out there.
I agree, absolutely, Parry said vehemently.
And what kind of fucking welcome committee is this anyway?
Irrational, directionless anger rose in her like bile.
We've come all this way, been dragged all this way, and all that happens is they drill a hole in the sky and then fuck off.
There's no sign of alien presence out there, Pegas said timidly. We did get a weird transient echo off something for a while, but it didn't show up again.
Svetlana rubbed tired eyes. She was close to tears, close to some kind of breaking point she did not want any of them to see.
What kind of echo?
Something small, something local. Maybe one of their probes leaving, Parry said.
Don't think so, Pegas said. If the probes showed up on radar, we'd have already seen them. This was a big fat bounce with a hint of rotation. Then it was gone.
Parry looked keen. So maybe there is something out there.
Or was, Svetlana said.
The opening of the sky had offered them hope. That was why they had all been so keen for it to stay open, for that glint of dawn to hold steady and true. But beyond the iron sky was just another kind of iron sky. More distant, more enormous, more inhuman, more oppressive.
Svetlana felt crushed. She knew that everyone else was feeling it as well, but was desperately trying not to show it, as if by an act of collective denial they could pretend that this was somehow good news.
Wait, Svetlana said, pressing fingers to her eyelids. I know what it is you saw. It must have been a piece of our junk, the free flyers that were still in the slipstream when the sky sealed up. They must have been out there all this time.
Maybe you're right, Pegas said glumly. I was hoping it might be something more exciting.
Maybe this is as good as it's going to get.
It's early days, Parry said, forcing strained optimism into his voice. Someone drilled through the sky, and they must have done it for a reason. Just because we don't see them immediately, it doesn't mean they won't be back.
We can go out and look for them, Pegas said suddenly. Fuel up Crusader or Avenger, see what's really out there. At the very least, we need to see deeper into the tube.
At least that way we'd be doing something, Parry agreed, instead of just sitting down here waiting for them to make the next move.
What if there is no next move? Svetlana said. What if they've let us out of one cage into another and that's it, end of story?
I can't believe that, Parry said. We were brought here for a reason, not just to be locked away in a pipe for the rest of eternity.
She looked at him sullenly. Maybe that was the reason. Even godlike aliens have to act rationally, don't they?
I wouldn't know, she said. I can't recall ever meeting any.
They sat in a brooding silence for half a minute. Svetlana looked at the flexi array again, with its intimations of further mysteries. Parry and Pegas were right, of course. They had waited 13 years for something to study beyond Janus itself, some key to the deeper purpose behind the deceitful moon. It had brought them here, and it had kept them alive during the flight. Maybe all that had been accidental, and they'd simply hitched a ride in the slipstream of something that neither knew of nor cared about their existence. But maybe it hadn't.
All right, she said, trying to shrug aside her own sense of fatalistic hopelessness. We take a look down the tube. We'll send a free flyer first and see what we turn up.
It wasn't good news. The probe encountered the end of the tube 2 light minutes downstream from Janus. First, its radar began to detect bounces from a solid structure blocking the tube. Closer, LIDAR and the optical cam recorded a circular plate 160,000 kilometers across, snugly filling the tube. By then, the free flyer had consumed most of its fuel and was speeding towards the end wall at its terminal velocity. The final images, transmitted back to Crabtree just before impact, revealed the presence of radial spokes running from the rim to a smaller wheel-shaped structure at the plate center, a mere 1,000 kilometers across. The grainy pictures suggested that the wheel-shaped structure was etched with inwardly curving lines, like the diaphragm in an old camera.
It's a door, Svetlana said.
No one saw any reason to argue with her. But the door was closed. It looked immeasurably ancient and heavy, like something that hadn't moved in 1,000,000 years. The free flyer dashed itself against the structure like a gnat against a dam. If it left a smear, there was no trace of it when a second free flyer sent back another set of images. A third free flyer had also been dispatched in the opposite direction. 1 light minute up the tube, it encountered a blank end cap with no trace of any door-like mechanisms. It died as well. Svetlana had deemed that a trio of free flyers could be sacrificed in the interests of speedy data acquisition, but that was as many machines as Crabtree could afford to lose.
Further investigations would need to be made using recoverable craft, slowly, with the minimal expenditure of fuel and logistics. At least now they knew that the tube was finite, and that there was nothing immediately threatening inside it. That, she supposed, could be construed as a kind of good news. But it was also bad, since there was still no sign of an alien welcoming committee. And the door and end cap both had the brutal look of something impenetrably thick, so thick that even their demolition nukes would be lucky to leave a scratch on them. They had established the parameters of their new prison, and the situation was not encouraging. That left the other piece of news. They had found something tumbling end over end in orbit around Janus. It was the object Pegas had already picked up on the Free Flyer radar, but Svetlana's original guess had been wrong. It was not one of the old Free Flyers that had been monitoring the slipstream when the Iron Sky had appeared. Of those, there was no longer any trace. This was something else, and it was not remotely what anyone had been expecting. In a way, it was good news, because it was a concrete sign that their arrival had been noticed and, unlike the opening of the sky, it appeared to be a message addressed specifically to them. The bad news was that it was odd, unsettling, and devoid of useful content, and ever so slightly threatening. It was a solid cube, exactly 2 meters along each side, and very black, although not so black that it hadn't thrown back a radar bounce. A manipulator-equipped Free Flyer was able to approach the object, touch it, and stabilize its tumble. It massed precisely 200 metric tons, but appeared otherwise quite inert and unresponsive. Svetlana weighed the risks and decided to permit the object to be brought back to Underhol for further study. A dome was thrown around the cube, initially unpressurized. Once a battery of tests had established that the cube probably wouldn't be harmed by the presence of air, it appeared to be chemically inert, the dome was flooded with a normal atmospheric trimix. Denise Nadis, Josef Protsenko, and Kristina Freer-Gomberg were running tests on the cube when Svetlana came to visit them, a day after the dome had been pressurized. In the harsh floods rigged around it, the cube was dismayingly black. Its surface albedo was exactly 0.999999 to the limits of measurement. As it rotated on the electric turntable installed under it, the cube became a chunk of abstract form, almost appearing to ooze from one shape to another as it turned from face to face. It was surrounded by monitoring devices mounted on spindly tripods, trailing tangles of optical data cables and thick, frayed, heavy-duty power lines. The cube was smooth on all but one of its six faces. X-ray and acoustic probing revealed no hints of interior structure. Surface analysis, using atomic force microscopes, drew blank on the matter of the object's composition. For an artifact that had presumably spent some time in space, even in the hermetic environment inside the tube, it was astonishingly free of imperfections. The cube's edges were still absurdly sharp. Must be self-renewing, the science team informed Svetlana, stuffed full of sleek, alien nanotech, correcting any fault or imperfection before it had a chance to register. No chemical analysis was possible because the surface was itself in a state of constant overhaul and flux. If they had better tools, they said ruefully, they might have been able to glimpse these processes in action. Except, as they all knew, the nanotech might not be alien at all. The cube's dimensions and mass suggested prior knowledge of human measurement systems. But that was not all. The sixth surface contained an engraving. It was turning towards her now. By some trick of surface effects, the finger-thick lines of the engraving had a higher albedo than the surrounding face. It was Da Vinci's drawing of a man standing in a box, one of the most familiar and iconic diagrams imaginable. It had been stylized, reduced to the essentials, but it was still recognizable. It seemed unlikely that any alien mind had created this cube. The technical team wore masks, gloves, and surgical scrubs, but that was just a token precaution. Nothing they'd measured had suggested that the cube was in any way harmful. It just sat there, revolving slowly on the turntable, presenting five blank faces and then the Da Vinci design. You can touch it if you like, Denise Nadis said, handing her a pair of recyclable surgical gloves inlaid with a matrix of haptic sensors. We've all done it. It's almost like a ritual. You don't really believe it's there until you've pressed a hand against it. Svetlana snapped on one of the gloves.
What would happen if I touched it with my bare skin? You'd leave a nasty set of fingerprints. One of us already tried. They faded with time, Christina Freer Gomberg said. No harm was done. I just had to know what that material felt like under my skin. The haptics weren't good enough. I had to know. What if there was a difference that the gloves weren't picking up?
And was there? Protsenko asked.
No, she said sullenly. It felt exactly the same. Svetlana's fingertips registered the tingle as the haptics engaged their microscopic contact cilia against her skin. She brushed her hand over the rough texture of her trousers and felt the bias of the fabric, as if the gloves were not there at all. She moved to the cube and touched one of the slowly turning blank faces. It was cold, solid, mute. It felt old, shockingly so, as if it had been waiting an eternity for this instant of human contact. Her fingers skirted the sharp edge as the next face revolved into view. She wondered, as they were surely all wondering, who had put this thing into orbit around Janus. What was its message? What were they meant to make of it? The next face hove into view. She had only put on one of the gloves. She glanced back and saw that Nadis, Protsenko, and Ofria Gomberg were preoccupied with a flexi readout. They were all looking down, not at her. Shielding her movements with her body, she reached out to touch the engraved face with her bare hand. Svetlana, Nadis called, I think you need to see this. She turned from the cube, snapping off the haptic glove before anyone noticed that she had only been wearing the one. Denise, she asked innocently, what is it?
It's the door, she said. It's closing.
She realized that she meant the door at the end of the shaft, 2 light minutes down the tube.
I didn't even know it was open.
Nor did we, Nadis said. It must have happened after we lost the second free flyer, before we got the hovering calm into place.
I don't like it, she said.
Then you're going to like this even less. Something came through.